The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I was getting dressed this morning, and my wife looked at me and said, "You're really not going to wear that tie, are you?" And I said, sure, because if I'm boring, people can at least look at the picture on my tie and be entertained. Unfortunately, I didn't know I'd have to be restricted to this fortress. And so you can't see my tie, and you just have to endure my boring words. Let's look again at this text, 1 Peter chapter 3. And let us hear what God has to say. It strikes me that the Bible is immensely practical. It tells us that our faith must show itself in practical ways. One of my favorite tests of faith is what the writer of Proverbs says in chapter 12, verse 10, where he states, "A righteous man regards the life of his beast, but the compassion of the wicked is cruel." Now, since I am surrounded where I live by beasts of every size and stripe, this test of the compassion of my heart regularly comes to the fore. You see, I live with three women, a wife and two daughters who love beasts. And so we have dogs and cats and goats and pigs and sheep and horses. And I have to live with these things. Now, we have a dog who lives in the house. Unfortunately, as far as my wife and daughters are concerned, that is the only beast allowed to live in the house. Now, because I don't particularly like animals, but I know my wife and daughters do, when they're around, I have to pretend that I enjoy these beasts. But when they're gone, and I am shut up alone with our dog, then my true heart attitude, you see, emerges. If I am really impatient with that beast, or if I am angry with that beast, or if I am generally anxious about all kinds of things, that fear, that anger, that lack of patience will come out in the way I treat that dog. Now, that's a pretty practical test of what's going on inside of me, isn't it? Well, Peter, in our text, reminds us that sometimes beasts walk on two legs. And even when we have to live with a two-legged beast, he wants a heart that is transformed by Jesus Christ to show itself. Now, he's been talking about beasts of all kinds from chapter 2, verse 13, all the way through to our text. In fact, he's been talking about difficult circumstances and persons who are difficult to get along with from the beginning of this book. And you know that. You've been spending time in this book, in this chapel period, this semester. And Peter is saying that when you're confronted with difficult people, And particularly, he's telling wives who must live with husbands who are disobedient to the word in the first six verses of chapter 3. And when he talks about husbands who are disobedient to the word, he's probably talking about husbands who are not Christians. It's interesting the way Peter uses that phrase. If you look at chapter 2, verse 8, he describes all those who are not Christians as disobedient to the word. There's an intimate connection between obedience and faith, so that the words faith in the word and disobedience to the word are almost interchangeable in Peter's mind. So when he talks about husbands who are disobedient to the word, he means they're not Christians. And these non-Christian husbands are making things difficult for these Christian wives. And Peter says, look, here's an opportunity for your faith to be tested. You are to handle that situation by letting the hidden person of the heart, do you see that in verse 4? You're to handle that difficult situation. You are to handle that difficult person by letting the hidden person of the heart show itself. You're not going to win him by arguing with him, Peter says. You're going to win him by letting the hidden person of the heart, that imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God, show itself. And as he observes that, he will be won. Now, this entire passage is rich. And we could go in a number of directions with all of these verses. One of the first things we want to do when we read these verses is get into an argument. And the egalitarians argue with the subordinatarians. And we want to look at words like obey in verse 6 and submit in verse 1 and the weaker vessel in verse 7. And we start focusing on the institution of the home and the roles in the home. And we say, now you see, isn't there something here about subordinationism that Peter kind of institutionalizes for all time? And if we do that, even though there might be some valuable things here about the role relationship in the home, but if we do that, I think we miss the point. Because I don't think Peter in these verses is trying to institutionalize for all time certain authority-subordinate relationships. No more than in chapter 2, verse 18, he's trying to institutionalize for all time slavery. Rather, what he's doing is saying that as your faith has turned your world upside down, as you've been persecuted and scattered throughout the world, you're going to find yourself in different relationships. Now, how will your newfound faith, how will your newfound Christianity inform your behavior in those relationships? If you find yourself as a slave living under a master, how does your faith inform that relationship? And if you find yourself as a wife living with an unbelieving husband, how does your faith inform that relationship? And if you are a husband who is now a Christian, how does that newfound faith inform the way you treat your wife? If you focus on the institutional subordinate authority relationships, I think you missed the point. The point is, how do you handle, as a Christian, relationships that are tough? I think all of us, regardless of our marital status, fit into the various relationships that Peter describes in these verses. In verses 1 through 6, he talks about being a Christian when you are under someone else's authority. And that someone under whose authority you live is disobedient to the word. Now, that may mean he's a non-Christian, or it may mean that he is a Christian, but sometimes he messes up. And he doesn't always exercise his authority in a godly way. Now, you all live under authority, whether you're married or not. Most of you in this room are students. That means you're under the authority of your professors. Your professors are under the authority of the administration. And the administration is under the authority of the board of directors. And sometimes your professors and sometimes the administration and sometimes the board of directors mess up and they make mistakes. They are disobedient to the word. How do you handle that? Verses 1 through 6 are for you. Peter says you got to handle that by submitting. Even if they mess up, you must submit. And he says you must submit in a respectful way. Look at that in verse 2. As they observe your chaste and respectful or reverential or fearful behavior, you must submit to that authority, even when that authority messes up, in a respectful, reverential way. And Peter says, you must submit not only in a reverential way, you must submit in a pure way. Look again at what he says in verse 2. This authority that messes up must observe your chaste or your pure behavior. Now, Peter isn't saying that wives have a chastity that is unique to them. He's just pulling in what he has already said about all of his hearers in chapter 1, verse 22. Where he says, we have all, in obedience to the truth, purified our souls. He's just taking that truth about all Christians and pulling it in to this particular authority relationship. So, when your authority messes up, you must submit in a respectful way, in a pure way, and may I add another thing? You must submit in an active way. The submission you bring to your authority that messes up has to be assertive and aggressive and active. Submission is not suffering in silence. Submission is not passive. Submission is an active, aggressive ministry that you bring to your authority. Now you say, where is that in the text? Let me point out just a few things. The word submission, verse 1, be submissive, appears in the middle voice, which means it's something you do for yourself. It's not something that you are made to do. It's not something that you are forced to do. You voluntarily submit yourself. You arrange yourself under the authority of the other person. And then look down at verse 6. Thus Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children. If you do what is right, submission in this context is doing something, not having something done to you, not just lying there and being told what to do. Submission is something that you do. Do what? Well, look down at verse 9. And in verses 9 and following, Peter kind of sums up this whole section, but look at what he says there. He says, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, for you were called for this very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing. You see, submission is not just the absence of something. It's not just the absence of evil. It's not just the absence of insult. Submission is the adding of something. That is, you give a blessing. In the presence of evil, you return love. Submission is an active, aggressive ministry of love and blessing that you bring to your authority, even when your authority never asks you or tells you to do a thing. Now, here's the question. What active ministry are you bringing to your authority that messes up? It's not enough just to refuse to complain or gossip. Okay, so you've got a teacher that's dull. Not around here, I know, but you got one who's dull. And you can't understand what he's trying to say. And you try to talk to him and he just kind of brushes you off. What do you do? How do you bring an active and a pure and a respectful submission to that person? It's not enough just to say, well, I won't gossip about him and I won't go home and complain about him to my wife. It's not enough just to have the absence of evil. You must have the presence of love. Do you pray for him? And notice I said pray for him, not against him. A lot of prayers are not prayers for, they're against. I've heard women pray for their husbands like this. Lord, you know my husband Jim, that drunk? Lord, he makes my life miserable. Change him, Lord. Give his heart no rest. Lay a heavy burden upon his soul until he repents. That's not a prayer for, it's a prayer against. Okay, now you might have some for stuff in there, but that's really not the tenor of it. You know, compare that with, Lord, help me to understand the heart of my husband, Jim. Help me to understand his struggles. Help me to understand his doubts and his fears. And Lord, you know what a hard time he has handling all of those things. Please be with him. Do you pray for your professors? Do you pray against? Do you bring an active ministry of submission to them? Well, that's what Peter says you must do. Now, there are lots of other things in those verses that we could comment on, but I think that's the genius of what he says. If you have an authority that's messing up, you must bring to that authority a respectful and a pure and an active submission. Well, let's look at verse 7, because here he introduces another category of relationship. Specifically, he addresses husbands, but we could call this category of relationship one in which you have the authority. You're not under someone else's authority, but you're in the position of authority, and there are others under your authority. And again, you know, that applies to us all. The professors here are over the students. The administration is over the professor. The board is over the administration. And so what Peter says here about that category of relationship applies. Now, just a word about that phrase, weaker vessel. When Peter talks about the weaker vessel, he's talking about one who is under my authority. Or the one who is under the authority of another. When he's talking about wives, he doesn't mean that they are weaker. Let's get that straight. You know, he isn't saying that constitutionally, inherently, women are necessarily weaker than men. Physically. He's not saying that they are weaker intellectually, or weaker emotionally, or weaker psychologically. I just don't think that can stand up to any kind of examination. What is he saying? He's saying that in all relationships of authority, there is a stronger position and a weaker position. So if you go back to chapter 2, verse 13 and 14, the governor, the king, is in the stronger position. The citizen is in the weaker position. And in verse 18, the master is in the stronger position. The servant or slave is in the weaker position. you look at verses 21 through 25. The civil and religious authorities were in the stronger authority position. Jesus, who submitted himself to them, was in the weaker authority position. You get to the first six verses that we looked at. The husband is in the stronger authority position. The wife is in the weaker authority position. That's what he's talking about when he talks about the wife as a weaker vessel. She is in the weaker authority position. And if you want to know what it's like to be in the weaker authority position, just remember the last time you were speeding down the highway and you looked in your rearview mirror and you saw that flashing light. And you heard just the beginning of that piercing siren. And you were caught. Chances are your stomach sunk. You felt weak. Because you were in the weaker authority position. Doesn't mean that that policeman is smarter than you. Doesn't mean that he's stronger than you. He's just in the stronger authority position. I think that's what Peter clearly means when he talks about the wife as the weaker vessel. But here's the thing. How do you treat those people who are under your authority? If submit is the word he gives to those who are under an authority, the word he gives to those who are in authority is the word no. Do you see it there in verse 7? You husbands, likewise, live with your wives according to knowledge, in an understanding way, since she is a woman. You must know. You must understand. You must get into the frame of reference of. That means you've got to figure out, you've got to identify with what it's like to be in that weaker position under your authority. I watched the Giants game on Monday night. And the trying of your faith works patience. Or the trying of my faith works patience. But at any rate, at halftime, those of you who watched the game, Lawrence Taylor's jersey number was retired. Do you know who Lawrence Taylor was? Is, okay. Just great football player, take it at that, all right? And his jersey was retired. And afterwards, which means that nobody else will ever wear that number again. And afterwards, he was interviewed. And one of the interviewers asked him, would you ever become a coach? He said, nah, I couldn't be a coach. And then he added, in all modesty, great players don't make great coaches. And what he meant was, great players are impatient with other players who are not as great as they are. And they expect that the other players to play at their level, to have the same talent, to be as quick, to catch on to things as quickly. And he says, I wouldn't be any good at that, so I wouldn't be a good coach. Now, it is interesting that if you look at all the sports, the best coaches, the best managers, are usually those who are just mediocre players. Why? Because they know what it's like to struggle. They know what it's like to be a mediocre player. They know what it's like to have to channel what little talent you have in the right direction. And because of that, they can, with knowledge, manage others. Peter's saying here, if I can bring this to a rapid conclusion. He's saying you've got to stop treating people like commodities. If you're a teacher, if you're a husband, if you're a president of the seminary, you can't treat people like commodities. A carpenter works with wood. That's a commodity. A produce man works with vegetables. That's a commodity. Sometimes I think teachers imagine that their commodity is students. Just like the carpenter works with wood, just like the produce man works with vegetables, they work with students. And they're just commodities to be manipulated, to be used for their own advantage. Peter says, no. You got to live with them according to knowledge. If we can pull up what he says in verse 8, one of those string of words he uses to talk about relationships in the church, he says you've got to be sympathetic. That means you've got to enter into their frame of reference. You've got to crawl inside their heart. You've got to look at the world the way they look at it. You've got to understand their fears, and you've got to understand their doubts. You've got to understand the things that they do well and the things they don't do so well and the kinds of problems they're having. You've got to deal with them as persons with whom you can relate, not commodities that you can manipulate. And if you don't do that, Peter says, you can't pray. You see that at the end of verse 7? He says, if you don't really know those people over whom you have the authority, if you don't grant them honor as fellow heirs of the grace of life, you can't pray. You know, usually I'm tempted to pray for my wife only about those things that make my life easier. Lord, make her a better cook. Lord, help her to keep the house cleaner. And probably if I work hard enough, I could find a good spiritual reason for those prayers. That's treating her like a commodity. Peter says, I got to get inside her heart. And I got to know the fears and the doubts and the weaknesses and the pain and the struggles and the temptations, so that when I pray for her, I pray according to knowledge. I pray for what's really there. So if you're in authority, there's Peter's word for you. Know. Identify with. Understand. Get in the frame of reference of that one for whom you have authority. And then he says, we don't have time. In that last category, verses 1 through 6, you got those who are under the authority of another. Verse 7, those who have authority. And in verse 8, he talks about those who are just peers, colleagues. There's not an authority structure. And he has a whole list of virtues there about how to live harmoniously or how to live of one mind. Testing of your faith. How do you live with your beast? How do you live with that person who isn't always easy to live with? Peter says you have to know and you have to submit. But let me point out just one thing. Verse 8 begins to sum up. That means it's tied into what's before it. Verse 7 begins with the word likewise, which means it's tied into what's above it. And verse 1 starts in the same way, which means it's connected to what precedes it. All of these things, all of the things that Paul or Peter has said in these 8 or 9 or 12 verses is tied to the end of chapter 2. And there he presents us with Christ, who submitted himself, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, did not revile in to the authority of his Father and to others. And you have one who exercised his authority in knowledge. And Peter says in verse 21, let that be your example. You lay your life upon him, and let God trace the outline of his life in you.